Welcome to Beyond the Petri Dish, a podcast where we dive deep into the captivating realm of clinical laboratory medicine and explore the impacts of our work beyond the lab bench. Join our hosts, Aaron Odegaard, a veteran laboratory scientist and aspiring stage actor with a heart of gold, Heather Netting, an experienced clinical microbiologist with a wealth of knowledge and not so subpar human, and Kyle McGee, scientist, scholar, inventor, and Skeeter's dad, as we uncover hidden stories from the lab, discuss the latest innovations within the field, and connect the dots between our work and the broader world of healthcare. Please remember that the thoughts, views, and opinions expressed in this podcast are solely those of the hosts and do not represent our employers, organizations, committees, or other entities. In this episode, we discuss
FDA wants to have oversight over laboratory developed tests. I don't know their motivation.
We need a rich scientist benefactor. Can we have like a Jeff Bezos, if you're out there listening? Stop building the rockets. Help us out, man.
Thank God I knew as much as I did about Elizabeth Holmes. Because we didn't plan that at all. I was like, oh, well, lucky for you, I know.
So join us as we journey beyond the Petri dish.
So Heather, do you got something for us to talk about? Something to talk about.
You know, I feel like you guys always rely on me to bring up like the biggest like elephant in the room. And yes,
that is true. And,
I feel like I'm gonna deliver. Let's talk about FDA's proposed rule change to have oversight over all LDTs instead of continuing to defer or beefing up the oversight that has been occurring with CLIA all of these years. I want to get you guys' initial thoughts, your initial reaction to the concept of, and just for the listeners that may not understand or know what I'm referring to.
You used a lot of letters in there. And
yeah, so LDTs, laboratory developed tests. This is seen by the FDA as any modification to an FDA-cleared test. So, for example, using CLSI breakpoints on an FDA-cleared device, or something to the effect of, you know, the LabCorps and the Quests of the world, they develop their own tests. There's a lot more focus on molecular tests that fall into this category, but they essentially develop their own tests, and they use it to perform testing on patient samples to generate results that are used for clinical decision-making. But they are developed by the laboratory, and they did not go through any type of FDA review. They don't have a 510K. It's a laboratory-developed test. Current state is that LDTs require additional testing. It's not just a verification. It's typically a validation. And there are more frequent requirements throughout the course of a 12-month span than you would typically encounter if you were just implementing an FDA-cleared test. The caveat to this is that CAP does not
Let me ask you. Okay, see, so you mentioned a lot of letters and words and that can be a little tough for people to understand, but like, so can you kind of just talk a little about what a validation is? Why do we have to do that? What is that?
Yeah, so verification versus validation. So when we are talking about verification, it is referring to a test that has undergone review and clearance by the FDA. And essentially, the lab is just tasked with verifying or proving that the claims, performance claims specifically, that were made by the manufacturer remain true when that particular test is being used in a specific laboratory setting and being performed by the staff who work in that individual laboratory. So a verification, while I would never consider it to be abbreviated, when compared to a validation, which I'll get into in a second, it is a little less work for the lab because the performance claims have already been established by the manufacturer, and the lab just has to prove that in its own environment, with its own staff, that those performance claims hold true. But go ahead.
So at any time, at this particular time, place, and environment, that everything's working the way it's supposed to.
Correct. But a validation is essentially the task, and there's a lot more to it than what I'm about to say, but at a high level, it is establishing those performance claims. So the lab is tasked, if they want to implement a laboratory developed test or an LDT, they have to establish the performance claims. So a verification for micro, specifically for AST, typically involves just verification of accuracy and reproducibility. A validation is much more involved. You have to determine the clinical efficacy. There are a lot of things in addition to that. Typically requires a significant amount more of testing. And there is a monetary cost for IVD manufacturers when they submit to the FDA seeking that clearance. And then, of course, there's some differences between a 510K clearance and other types of clearances from the FDA, blah, 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 right?
You sound very, very smart. What is accuracy and what's reproducibility? So,
accuracy
be?
So... I'm going to use an AST test since that's what brought us here antimicrobial susceptibility testing for any listeners that are not intimately aware of these things. I will try to avoid using acronyms, but AST, antimicrobial susceptibility testing.
And you sound very smart.
Mm-hmm. I know. If you throw out enough acronyms, man, anybody can sound like they know what they're talking about. Whoa. That's what I'm doing right now. I don't actually have any idea what I'm talking about. Kidding.
You sound brilliant.
Yes. So accuracy is how close the result that's generated by the new test method that you are trying to implement is to the already verified and implemented FDA cleared test that you're using as your comparator method. So for the purpose of AST, accuracy is measured in two ways, essential agreement and categorical agreement. Essential agreement is focused specifically on the MIC value that's generated by the new test that you're seeking to implement, comparing that to the MIC value that was generated for that same isolate on the test that is already in use. So
is it kind of like if the right answer is 7? And it's how close everyone is to 7?
Well, so kind of, but there's a caveat to that for the purpose of essential agreement for the reasons that we are discussing it here. Okay. It is in essential agreement if it is within plus or minus 1 doubling dilution of each other. So if you were to have dilution series of, let's say, 0.5, 1, 2, 4. So those are doubling dilutions, 0.5 times 2, 1, 1 times 2, 2, 2 times 2, 4, right?
So much, math.
I know, it's a lot of mathing. No, I'm not. I'm going to stop there because I am sure that I'll mess up if I keep going and then everybody will laugh at me. And so basically, if you get an MIC value of 1 generated by the new test that you're trying to implement, and an MIC value of 0.5 from the comparator method that is already actively in use on patient samples, you are within that plus or minus 1 doubling dilution because you get 0.5 and 1. Now, if the new method were to give you an MIC value of 2 and the comparator method were to give you an MIC value of 0.5, That is two doubling dilutions apart. So that particular result is not within essential agreement.
So this sounds really complicated. Is this something that just happens real quick? Like, you can't just throw it in there and just like do 20 like bacterias and be done?
Yeah, no, 20 bacterias, also known as isolates to this community, is usually not going to be sufficient. There are additional requirements within that realm of EA, CA, accuracy, reproducibility. And one of those requirements, which is not clearly defined, unfortunately, for all of our lab folks that are hoping to get a little insight on exactly the number of tests that they need to run to implement a new AST test. The problem is that the minimum requirement is different amongst different regulatory bodies. But I think the general consensus in the microbiology community, as is the actual requirement for some of our more lab-specific oversight agencies, is that for an AST test specifically, you have to generate a minimum of 30 data points for each antimicrobial that you are trying to implement on this new test platform.
Yeah. And then luckily the CLSI, so the Clinical Laboratory Standards Institute, helps kind of define that a little bit. But from a quality standpoint too, it depends on your medical director too, what they want you to 100%. Do as well.
100%. Yep. At the end of the day, if all of our regulatory agencies say that you must have 30 data points for every antimicrobial you are trying to implement, but your medical director or lab director says, I want you to have 60, at the end of the day, it's their call. They're the ones that make the rules, as long as the rules that they make are not less than the defined minimum requirements.
Okay, so you've mentioned all these numbers and all this hard work that has to be done. Yeah, I'm good at math. So we're doing all this work, all this scary math for these validations. So why the need or want for FDA oversight? Like, why do we need them?
So FDA wants to have oversight over laboratory developed tests. I don't know. I don't know their motivation. Their motivation is supposedly
safety?
patient safety. And I do recognize that motivation. But the question that I have in general, I don't know who this question is for, maybe you guys can answer, is while they are in charge of approving, denying, recognizing any IVD test that hits the market, that is, you know, a 510K clearance, obviously that is the premise of it. When it comes to a very specific test that's developed by an individual laboratory, usually motivated by that laboratory, hospital, institution, or region's patient population, I have to start to question why the FDA feels that they know best about the accuracy, efficacy of that type of test, as long as the lab meets the minimum requirements that have been mandated to date. Now, the argument is that it has been a very loose set of requirements, which I would argue against in that statement in general, that they feel that while laboratories and regulatory bodies like CLIA are specialists in laboratory medicine, that the FDA specializes in understanding testing or diagnostic tests, devices, all of the things that fall under the FDA now. But here is the kicker of all of this. At first, I've been very, very, very against this proposed rule. And I still kind of am, because I don't fully have my head wrapped around all of the requirements or the burden that it would have on the lab, because it's going to be a tremendous burden. What they are essentially asking is for laboratories to submit something similar to what a diagnostic manufacturer would have to submit to get a 510K clearance. So to be able to say, we are FDA clear, this is IVD labeling, you can go ahead and use it. And of course, once a manufacturer does that, then any lab can adopt that test that's cleared by the FDA by only performing a verification and not having to do a validation, which is what they're proposing, almost the equivalent of a 510K submission.
Okay, so just real quick for our listeners, what does IVD stand for? Like
in vitro diagnostics.
The test we get to do in the lab?
Mm-hmm. Cool. It basically has the stamp of approval by the FDA that we have reviewed the performance claims and we're comfortable with this being used broadly for patient testing, for testing on patient samples.
And this is definitely not something you can just apply for and fast track where it's like, let me just fill out this application. It'll be done in 2 days.
No. It requires a pretty significant amount of time, labor. There's a financial component, too. There's a high cost associated with it that isn't necessarily as publicly assessed or acknowledged because IVD manufacturers, they take into consideration the cost of a 510K clearance application with all of their other costs, whereas the lab, they can barely afford, paying their most tenured techs what they probably deserve. So this is something that is not necessarily considered in their budget, something that is going to be pretty burdensome on the lab. And for all of these reasons, it is just going to be almost impossible for some labs in particular. Now, the LabCorp and the Quest, like, they'll probably be able to find the funding for this, and they are the primary source of a lot of our laboratory developed tests. But some of your smaller hospital labs, they just simply don't have the resources from all perspectives to accommodate for this new oversight by the FDA, because they're essentially proposing that labs submit a 510K clearance application if they want to utilize a certain test that was designed for their specific patient population.
Yeah. And that's kind of why I was leaning more on the fence about it. And just to clarify, like with the 510 authorization pathway, it's specific to those medical devices, not the actual lab tests, but I am on the fence about it because, if you're not a major reference lab that has all this money to put into this big lengthy process that you just kind of described to our viewers, you're kind of stuck. You're limiting what testing you can do based on all this extra oversight that's meant to do great things, but at the same time is kind of limiting what we can do.
Yeah. So I started to do a little bit more research into this because, of course, my feathers are ruffled. I'm like, come on. Yeah. I'm like, come on, FDA.
Who are you to tell me what I can do?
Give the lab a break, right? Give the lab a break.
You're like, but then Aaron, Kyle, you got me. Hold me back.
I started to realize that a lot of the LDTs that exist now were a result of a loophole that was discovered when LDTs first became formalized. And I'm not against that. I think that you guys know, and it will only be a matter of time before everybody starts to realize that, like I like the idea of a loophole. I like it. I maybe should have been a lawyer. Maybe I will be in another life.
You're like, well, actually, Clause 27D says that
exactly.
I can use this doubling dilution on this antibiotic for. And that's, just to kind of get back to the antibiotic thing too, for like the actual like automated panels and things that we test with, when we look at different concentrations of antibiotics, it even takes the people making these panels long times to resubmit. When we change the breakpoints for these antibiotics, they have to even change up the equipment, so that even takes time, and that slows us up too. So there's a lot of regulatory stuff not untrue.
But because I was super focused on this loophole concept, I had a bit of an epiphany that
loop us in, Heather.
It's going to require a lot of research. because
work. Oh man. Okay.
I know these proposed rule changes have a lot of legal jargon and they're very long, and I'm the ADD poster child.
It's like the
so
disclaimer
I,
you click that I agree to the terms of my cell phone, and it could be you signed it with your first child.
Yeah. So while I don't fully have my head wrapped around specifically the requirements for the lab, from what I understand broadly is that they will essentially be having to submit to the FDA what will be pretty darn close to equivalent to a 510K submission for clearance. I think I've got an idea. So 510K clearance. You submit to the FDA, you have a bunch of data, you pay them a fee, they review your results. And then if you are granted that clearance, they basically say, this is IVD. You are allowed to sell this as a cleared device or test to any lab in the country, right? And then they can adopt it or implement it.
It's almost like a manufacturer guaranteed stamped by the FDA.
Yeah.
Okay, and I gotcha.
Then they can just do a verification instead of a full-blown validation. They can just confirm.
That's less work?
Yes.
Is it less math?
Less work
too?
To do
less
a verification.
Math?
Probably not. Oh. Maybe. But depends on who you ask. So basically, the FDA giving 510K clearance to a current IVD manufacturer makes it so that they are released and able to sell, market their product into any clinical lab in the country. And that lab can say, I don't have to establish my own performance claims. I can implement this through the verification route instead of the validation route. So here's my epiphany. I know that it seems really burdensome for the lab to have to go through this process. But what if, as a community, as a laboratory community, if they propose this rule gets approved and FDA now oversees LDTs, can we as a laboratory community band together so that one submission by Quest or LabCorp, whereas it used to be siloed for use at Quest or at LabCorp, and if the lab down the street wanted to implement it, they had to do their whole thing, a validation to implement this test also as an LDT. Maybe we have all of these labs go through this submission. It essentially becomes recognized by the FDA. It becomes an IVD test. And then the rest of the laboratory community can implement it as a verification. And maybe we all work together so that not everybody's submitting for their own individual quote unquote clearance, and everybody can piggyback off of each other. And I'm looking at you, CLSI, looking at you, CLSI, because wow, all of our very laboratory specific regulatory bodies view the implementation of CLSI breakpoints on an FDA cleared AST device as an off-label laboratory developed test, or they view it actually as a modified FDA cleared test, but the FDA sees it as a true off-label LDT. Maybe CLSI submits for quote unquote 510K clearance under this newly proposed rule. They get said clearance, CLSI breakpoints become recognized by the FDA. And once they become recognized by the FDA, they are an FDA cleared concept, not a device in this scenario. And then labs no longer even have to go through the implementation process that is more labor intensive, costly, that they do even today, trying to implement CLSI breakpoints on an FDA cleared AST test. They piggyback off of this new requirement. And there is a back door, there's a loophole that we get all of these LDTs recognized by the FDA, and then labs can implement them via the verification route. What do you guys think?
I'll get the website going right now. We'll call it One Lab.
Yeah, everybody just volunteers. I'll do this one. I'll do this one. I'll do this one. We cover all the LDTs in the country. They become IVD. They're FDA cleared, and now anybody can implement them.
And that's that's the story
for you and me.
That's the story of how we start our own reference lab. Just kidding.
I don't think that this is that crazy. Like, it sounds crazy.
No, but it's. I mean, it's tough.
It's kind of
like if, with lab developed tests, it's your homegrown test you're making in your lab. So it'd be kind of like if I was making.
Share the wealth.
Making beer in my garage. And Kyle was making beer in his garage. And then you're making beer in your garage.
Well, nobody's going to force me to make your beer in my garage, Aaron. Nobody's going to force me to do that.
Yeah, but are they all going to be the highest quality? And I think that's what they're trying to get at. Are they all going to be?
But the FDA is not going to recognize it.
In my garage, probably not.
The FDA is saying we want to have oversight over this just in case it's not the highest quality. And so they aren't going to approve or recognize things that shouldn't be distributed to other labs and implemented. But the things that get through that process, the same process that IVD manufacturers have to go through.
We've all seen those scary documentaries where stuff has still gotten through the FDA.
Okay, I'm not
people with like the cobalt hips.
I'm not speaking specifically to Elizabeth Holmes here. Okay.
Dun dun dun.
Did Elizabeth Holmes ever even get FDA clearance? I'm pretty sure they were trying to go through the laboratory.
For one thing, at least.
Okay. Yeah, I'm pretty sure they were trying to go through the LDT route because there was a little bit more gray. Isn't that right?
No, they were trying to submit for 510K clearance, and they were granted that clearance on at least one of their mini assays. Like not a panel. It was like one test. And I don't remember specifically what it was, but they did get FDA clearance for that.
Yeah, it just happened that she had a FDA cleared instrument in the basement running the tests. That she was pretending.
But I'm just saying, let them have oversight if that's what they want. Let them filter it out. Let them acknowledge or approve certain things that labs have been having to do all this extra work to maintain and continue to perform. And once they give that stamp of approval, it's done. And any lab can adopt it through the verification route, like CLSI breakpoints.
Exactly. Well, it's tough too, because we only have so many pennies. Now you're wanting us to spend the little pennies we have doing even more to guarantee a test that is already going to be working well for our patient.
Hence the banning together. Maybe there's a GoFundMe
for extraordinary
LDT
people.
Submission. And everybody's like, I'll take this one. I'll take that one. I've got a bunch of data over here. And then we get funding.
We're the Laboratory Avengers.
Yes. And then we get funding as a community to basically just mass submit all of these laboratory developed tests, get them recognized and cleared by the FDA.
Need a rich scientist benefactor. Yeah. Can we have Jeff Bezos, if you're out there listening?
Yeah. And then every lab
building the rockets.
Every lab can
help
bring
us out,
in
man.
The specific COVID test. Or they realize the other outcome of this is that if the laboratory community bands together and we just submit this influx of all these LDTs that were originally designed to cover a very specific patient population, that the FDA comes to the realization that they were designed to cover a very specific patient population. And when they're reviewing them, the results look great in that patient population, but they realize that maybe FDA recognition and oversight to this caliber isn't a good idea because these LDTs were designed for a very specific patient population. And then they say, now we understand why you were against this from the first, from the start.
I mean, does that assume that everyone has the same instrumentation and same platform for testing? That
we all do it
the same way with the same equipment?
If you were to follow this theoretical path of excitement and pizzazz that I'm proposing here.
So lab anarchy. this is America. Okay. You got to have multiple companies.
Okay, so all of our commercial AST devices are cleared by the FDA for use with FDA breakpoints. If you want to use CLSI breakpoints, which, I mean, I would actually invite any lab that is any clinical lab in the U.S. that is not using CLSI breakpoints primarily on their FDA cleared AST device, I would love for them to speak up and say, we don't use CLSI, because my general assumption is that all labs in the U.S. generally default to CLSI breakpoints. And so.
Yeah, no. Well, and the FDA has been working to update them to match CLSI. So that's still a work in progress, but that's been happening for quite a while. Because even when I got my master's degree 5 years ago, they were working on making the FDA breakpoints match up with the CLSI one. So the breakpoint's just that point that where the drug actually works. So
and we're closing that gap for sure. But there are certainly still breakpoints that are recognized by CLSI and have not been adopted by FDA. And those are the ones that labs are currently using. And so what if CLSI said, I have all this data. CLSI has data that they use to establish their breakpoints in the first place. They didn't just like pick them out of the left field and say, like, these seem right. And I also love to oppose the FDA because that's fun for me. Like, and it's fun for me to make labs jump through hoops unnecessarily to provide like a high standard patient of care. They have the data. What if they just said, you're taking too long, you're proposing this rule, we are submitting for recognition and clearance of our breakpoints.
Oh, people love when you tell them you're taking too long.
But FDA is the one that's going to be responsible for proposing this rule. And so how are they going to combat that? If CLSI is like, surprise, we're submitting for recognition of our LDT known as CLSI breakpoints on an FDA cleared device. And then labs wouldn't even have to do a validation or whatever they deem to be necessary to implement a modified FDA cleared test, which is not quite an LDT in the laboratory community, but seen as an LDT by the FDA. Then they recognize the CLSI breakpoints. What is their STIC website going to say?
I think in a magical universe where the FDA would actually do this, it would be wonderful. But I think the FDA was going to be like, we're the FDA. Sit down. We'll tell you when we're ready.
If they mandate that they will oversee all LDTs, in my opinion, all submissions are on the table. And I don't understand why this wouldn't be accepted or reviewed with the potential of being cleared or recognized. Again, my disclaimer is I don't know fully all of the requirements that the FDA would have for submitting for recognition of a laboratory developed test, but it sounds to me like it's going to be pretty freaking equivalent to a 510K that is required by an IVD manufacturer. So I think this is a loophole.
I know.
I think this is a loophole. And it makes me say, maybe we just let this happen. We stop fighting it. And then in the long run, it'll be beneficial. But again, there could be gaps in my knowledge and understanding of what this rule entails that would make it so that wouldn't be possible. But it feels like it would be.
Well, I am hoping the fight continues on. But it will be good that we have a backup plan for our testing revolution if it comes down to it, that we do need. We need something. Mm-hmm. Yeah, so I'm glad people are still kind of fighting and advocating for it, because the Clinical Laboratory Standard Institute, the group that gives that guidance, it's run by volunteers. So a lot of work.
Fingers crossed till April.
Fingers crossed. Say a little prayer over the petri dishes.
Over your molecular homebrew
tests. Holy, please.
Okay, Kyle. Aaron and I just had a conversation that I feel like we just didn't get your take on. So now I would like to turn it over to you to either respond to that topic or
to break.
Well, I was going to say, how do you break the tie?
Who wins, Kyle?
Follow up with that.
The FDA or the...
You covered every aspect. It was great. I don't really have much input. I think it sucks. I think it's going to be more work on the labs, which is the last thing we need considering current staffing shortages and the amount of work that's already required to, you know, verify and validate a new test in the laboratory. So yeah, it's unfortunate. But like you said, hopefully, you know, if this does get passed, hopefully some good can come out of it in the long run.
Can you imagine, like, the mud on FDA's face if they created a situation that would have to fast track their recognition of CLSI breakpoints?
Well, and so have you guys worked with lab developed test? Have you noticed a huge difference in anything with them? I mean, they're just as safe from what you've seen.
I mean, from what I have experienced, but the most common LDT that I have touched has been the one that is very different depending on who you ask as to its LDT status, and that would be CLSI breakpoints on an FDA cleared AST device. I don't see that as an LDT. I just don't.
Okay, Kyle, have you gotten to use any lab developed tests?
Yeah, I was gonna say AST comes to mind. Wasn't Molotov like an LDT before they got FDA? It was like research use only and went out with a disclaimer. There was that for a little bit. But I know there are some in molecular, but I don't really have too much experience with those.
Okay.
So
kind of those specialized tests that might not have thousands and thousands and thousands of patients. So that allows you to kind of test for some things that are a little more specific.
Yeah. Well, weren't they, I think in chemistry, weren't they doing like LDTs for like vitamin D levels?
Yes, I remember this.
Yeah. So that's pretty prominent. I know that's becoming more important in patients' health, is being able to measure that. That's having some direct correlation with certain disease states and whatnot. So yeah, I mean, I'm sure there's a long list. I mean, I can't speak to like chemistry or hematology, but I'm sure they're everywhere.
Yeah, but I guess you can have a modified FDA test, so where you just slightly modify what's been approved by the FDA and you do a little extra work there. But I guess kind of what I was trying to get at is, from what you've seen in the lab when you've been doing like the LDT tests or the FDA cleared tests, you're still doing the same level of due diligence. You're still doing your quality control. You're still doing those extra steps. So it's kind of like, why do we need this additional oversight? Why do we need to be paying all this extra money? Why now? So that's kind of...
There it is right there. Money.
I understand there's...
It's about to say.
I'm kidding.
It's probably
kidding.
For the same
Maybe
reason that some states target cars with an out-of-state license plate and pull them over before they would pull over someone in-state, because it's revenue generator.
Yeah. And you can always point to kind of like a bad person in the mix. Elizabeth Holmes is always a great example of that.
I want to talk about our feelings about Elizabeth Holmes. If
we're talking about my feelings,
no, I want to, you know, Kyle, you're up first on the spot. What are your thoughts about Elizabeth Holmes as a person and the situation surrounding her situation?
Yeah, I think she misled a lot of people. And I know the outcome of that case was that she didn't cause anyone any type of harm, but I disagree with that wholeheartedly.
So just in case people don't know who Elizabeth Holmes is, Kyle, can you tell us a little bit about her?
She was a Stanford dropout that started a blood testing company, and her claim, or the claim of her device that she created, I think it was the Edison, was that it could do like, what, 300 plus tests on one drop of blood or something crazy.
One drop, just
one. And it was like this 10-year like fiasco, and she was able to get all these high profile names to, you know, give her money, and pretty much anyone that was anything in Silicon Valley or really anything, you know, in the world, was putting their money towards this device. And she was making bold claims like this is being used in the battlefields with our American army, and it's in all these hospitals, and you know, like patients no longer have to like get these crazy blood draws. We can just do one drop, and it was 10 years worth of claims that weren't ever proven. You know, it's mind-boggling that she was able to even get away with it for 10 years. 10 years of people giving her money.
What was happening behind the scenes?
Short, what was going on behind the scenes is that the machine didn't work. She did, like Heather said, get apparently FDA clearance for what I think, if I remember correctly, she created a very nifty point-of-care device to run a small handful of tests that I think I saw like a retrospective analysis on Elizabeth Holmes where the point-of-care device that she did create actually did have some applications in like point-of-care laboratories, things of that nature. The retrospective analysis was pretty much saying like she could have started there and then continue to, you know, generate revenue so that she could eventually make what she wanted to make. But instead of doing that, she refused to accept the fact that the current state of the machine couldn't do what she was claiming it could do, and she just continued to lie. And I remember she ended up signing a partnership with Walgreens, and it was, yeah. I think what it was is that Walgreens has like FOMO that they were going to, you know, miss out, and CVS was going to get this exclusive contract. So they're like, they sent like a, I forget the guy's name, but they sent like a lab consultant and to like check the technology. And he does like lab consulting for a bunch of people. He went in and he simply just said, show me the device, show me, you know, what it can do, show me, you know, QC logs, like, I want to see everything. And they refused to show him this stuff because this is why I think was the kicker is apparently he used to work for Quest Diagnostics. And so what they said was, well, we can't let him see the device because he's worked for Quest. He might try to steal our IP and give it back to Quest.
Is that really that far-fetched?
Yeah.
Though?
It kind of isn't. I mean, I guess I could see why might be kind of they might have that impression, but at the same time, it's like Walgreens hired this guy so they can validate your technology so they can sign this deal, and they weren't able to do that, and they signed the deal anyways. And I think they only rolled out the device in like the Silicon Valley area, but pretty quickly, that's when things started to kind of like where like people started poking holes in the technology, and things just weren't making sense with the tests that were coming back. And I think what they ended up doing is they ended up taking the drops of blood that they collected in some cases, took it back to their Kappa Credit lab in Silicon Valley, and then they would dilute it down with water or saline and then run that on the machine. And then in some cases, I heard reports that they would still collect a drop of blood for that point of care device that could do those small handful of tests. And then they would still collect 3 or 4 tubes of other.
Yeah.
And then run those.
They were running it on a Siemens device that could perform
analyzer,
could perform the same testing.
There were patients that reported that they were saying, oh, I just need the drop of blood, but then they'd be like, oh, we need to collect a tube. And then from what I'd heard, lab professionals that were there were starting to raise concerns and raise red flags too.
Yeah, and there were a lot of whistleblowers. Devil's advocate though, like I find it very hard to believe that it was just her and Sunny that were playing this game. Like, I'm surprised there weren't more people from the company pulled in. I don't have a read on how big the company was after 10 years before it like went down, but I don't know. I just always thought that was odd. I'm surprised there weren't more people held accountable aside from them.
So Kyle, do you think that Elizabeth Holmes through the course of the 10 years was wrong the entire time?
When you say wrong the entire time, in terms of her mission or?
Like that she was essentially being a criminal from day one.
Oh, no. She probably went into it, you know, with good intentions, but just, you know, as she got into the thick of it, just didn't know how to get out. So she just kept digging herself deeper, as some people tend to do.
Do you think that her funding situation or sort of FDA sweeping under the rug situation? Do you feel that's all on her? Like she's just a manipulative mastermind?
I do think that she definitely misled investors. Whether or not it was just her, I wasn't in the company. You would have just thought there would have been more parties involved than just her and Sunny, but maybe that was how the company operated. Mm-hmm. Maybe it really was just those two and everybody else was kind of kept in the dark. I don't know, but
Go ahead, Aaron. I was just going to say, do you think it was, she panicked. She thought that the tech could work. And then she kind of held on to the whole Edison thing that, he faked it until he made it. So maybe I can just keep collecting money and hopefully they'll catch up.
I know she was like infatuated with Steve Jobs. And I think she would just really, Steve Jobs was very much so the kind of person where if he had an idea, he would present it to his team and he just, didn't take no for an answer. And I think that's just how she approached this particular device, is that people kept telling her it couldn't be done and she didn't care. And she's like, we'll just make it happen. And then she just continued to keep, shaping that story until it fell apart.
Hey, Kyle, Aaron, can I borrow $20 to put gas in my car? Just 20.
Tell me a story. No, give me a vision.
I borrow $20. I need gas. I'm out of gas. Can I have it? Yeah?
Yeah. Yeah. You're a subpar human. I'll give you
Aaron,
$20.
Can I have $20 for gas?
Sure, why not? Yeah, I'll give you $20.
Okay, so I have $40. If I use that $40 to buy drugs, is that not also equally your fault for giving it to me? Like, yeah, I told you it was for gas, but you didn't do your due diligence to find out if I actually needed gas or if I wanted to buy drugs. So is that really all on me? I'm not saying I'm not to blame.
Fair. So, and that has been some of the criticism, is that the investors should have done their due diligence and validated, all these claims. But at the same time, whenever they did try to do their due diligence, she would falsify documents and present them with falsified documents.
And they should have never given her the money in the first place. But while I'm not giving her a free pass by any means, I don't think that her manipulative nature to acquire what she needed to continue to manipulate can 100% be pinned on her. If you're going to give large sums of money in the millions and billions of dollars and you're trusting somebody's word of mouth, that is on you too. That's on you.
But that's what I was kind of saying. It wasn't just word of mouth. She falsified documents saying that these claims were backed up by X, Y, and Z organizations.
But I kind of see Heather's point. I mean, there was, when she was asking us each for $20, I at least paused for a minute to go, is she using this for gas? That was $20. And people are giving millions and millions of dollars. Even with falsified documents, I'd want to. And she did falsify some demo runs of it as well, but I'd want to see a little more accountability. Yeah. I'd love to be able to be rich enough to be like, oh yeah, take $1 trillion. It's
like
fine.
No biggie. Like, I don't need to check the
I got
paperwork.
I can go down to 3 jets instead of 4.
Heather, all right. A lot of people that were throwing money at it were only throwing money at it because so-and-so other person was throwing money on it. So there was a large sum of investors, I'm sure, that were only doing it because other people were doing it. So I get that argument.
Yeah, if you see like a former president or former heads of state, and you're like, oh, okay, well, Selena Gomez she's given the money, so I need to do it too. So I could see how you get caught in that.
I think
the hype.
Everybody had FOMO, I think. They were missing out. I don't know if I had to define that.
I almost missed out on it, so thank you, Kyle.
Yeah, I think that the Elizabeth Holmes situation has been a blessing and a curse to the LDT situation, just tying it all back together, that there was a time where people would just trust that, like, this thing is going to work and it's going to do the right thing. So I think that if we are looking for a true and solid lesson here, it is that in the scientific community, we can't just take people for their word. That's why data has always been necessary in all of these scenarios. I do think that there is a small part of that concept that is driving this FDA oversight concept. But at the same time, I think that there are other factors that are unnecessary that are making it so it's just burdensome instead of collaborative. So a collaborative situation, in my opinion, with Elizabeth Holmes would have been, I'll work with you. I'll fund it. I want to be a part of it. I need information all the time. And if you can't produce that information, you don't get any funding anymore. And I think because this scenario unfolded in the extreme way that it did, that some of our investors are put more to the test. They say, we're going to put you through the ringer before we just give you these large sums of money, like more so than they would have in the past, which is problematic in some situations for startups that have this dream. They have this vision, they have this thing, and they believe in it and they believe it's true. And then all of these investors are like, I don't want this to be the next Elizabeth Holmes. I'm not giving you a dime until you can prove something, but I can't prove something until I have money to fund support to generate the proof.
Well, and then she was even clever the way she kind of did things, where she'd keep people siloed. She'd have one division working on this, another working on something else, and not share what each group was doing. And you could even to get away from the LDT, I probably shouldn't, but you can kind of even think about how we were in the lab. We're kind of siloed at points. So we need to be less siloed in our everyday practices, but and we need more lab professionals. This is another great example of why we need more programs. Because if we had more certified lab professionals in there, more red flags. But yeah, she's a wild one.
Aaron,
yeah, let's not get started on certification.
I'm sorry, another conversation, another time, another episode, Kyle. Oh gosh.
Aaron.
It's been on my mind.
Aaron, do you think that Elizabeth Holmes was deceitful from the start?
I believe she had good intentions. She had a lot of people that were pointing to that the tech couldn't work the way she wanted it to. So I feel like
she was naive.
Yeah, she was naive, and I think she had people that kept pushing her in one direction, and then she was able to sell her vision to everyone, and then just got away from her. And instead of realizing she's not a Steve Jobs or a Jeff Bezos or something.
The one thing that really, like, I still can't wrap my head around is how, like, I had a friend that I was like talking to him about this. He's like, yeah, way back in the day, she actually came and toured our laboratory. And he had a very high opinion of her from that meeting, because he showed her around the lab and everything like that. And he, like, more or less, he even said, yeah, she even kind of like fooled me. Like, and like, I mean, I just, like, you see interviews with her, and I was just like, I don't see it. I don't see this, you know, awe-inspiring figure person. I don't know, maybe I'm missing something, but
she should have just submitted all of her data as an LDT.
Oh,
this particular. So my friend that met her, you'll find this interesting. He showed her like all the machines in the laboratory and what everything does. And she said to him, isn't it kind of annoying that you had to have so many machines to do all these different tests? Wouldn't it be a lot easier just to have one machine for everything? You know, of course it would be nice, but that's not where we're at right now with the technology.
And this may be an unpopular opinion, I believe for probably a more extended period of time than what the general public acknowledges, that Elizabeth Holmes had the right intentions. Do I think it's okay that she lied? No. Do I think the first time she lied that she truly believed that she just needed a little more time? Still not okay. Not saying it's okay. So that is my disclaimer. But I think the first time she lied was not malicious, that she was like, I just need just a little more time, because there were these like tiny bursts of hope in the progression of what she envisioned as her end goal. I don't think that from the beginning she sought out to manipulate people, that she sought out to lie, that she wanted to, I think she wanted to disrupt the community of medical devices and testing. I certainly don't think that her intention was to ever do it in the way that she ended up doing. And I think that that first lie was still a lie, not okay. But I think the first lie was innocent, that she was like, just give me that time that I need. But then she realized how easy it was to convince people, and she could sweep the thing under the rug and hide the thing. And I think the subsequent lies, there were a couple where she truly believed, like, I still just need a little more time. But in my opinion, as much as lying, especially in a medical device community, is never okay, I can kind of side with her on the first one. That, like, she was like, no, I think that I just need like two more days. And since you need an answer today, I have to give you this answer. And she truly, truly believed that the device that she had envisioned would do all the things that she envisioned that it would be capable of doing. And so I could almost forgive her for the first lie, despite the fact that there is a quality component and a patient care aspect in that. And people may not love this opinion, but I can see that. But then the subsequent lies started to become absolutely unacceptable because they were truly told from a viewpoint of, I want to deceive these people. I see that it doesn't work. I'm not willing to be honest about the fact that it doesn't work. I still believe that she thought in the long run she was going to make it work. I don't think she ever lied knowing that the end would not ever be what she envisioned it to be. I don't think that ever actually happened. I just think that she was buying herself time and time and time and time. And she should have recognized that there was a certain point where she just needed to come forward and say, we need a lot more time than I thought, instead of just lying. Yeah. But I don't think she sought out to deceive people ever.
You're right. I mean, initially she did seek to help people, but in turn, by going, oh, I need more time, and being deceptive, she actually was doing something that was going to harm lots of people.
Absolutely.
This is lost sight of what was important. But yeah,
I agree with that.
Oh, I just need more time. I just need more time. But
and she should have just said that. She should have just said, it's not what I thought it would be at this time. The end goal has not changed. It remains the same. My motivation is the same as it always has been. But we're just not where I thought we would be at this time. So we're going to have to scale back on what I believe we can produce by XYZ timeline.
And she might have gotten that time that she needed.
Yeah, the expertise.
Something that could have helped. Yeah.
If you have enough people throwing millions and billions of dollars at a concept, eventually you will find the person that can make it happen if it's possible. And she just, in my opinion, that's where she went wrong initially, is she didn't allow for that situation to unfold. Because if she had just said, we've gotten to a point and I don't know where to go from here, and I have this vision and I think that it's going to work, I just need all the right people, and maybe I don't have this person with this expertise. And she had just publicized, we're not where we need to be. That person with that expertise could have very well been like, I can do it. Let me try. And then she might never have been in the situation she's in. She might have just been a little slower to completion, in my opinion.
I mean, it does help kind of to pull everything back to the LDTs. The FDA does have good things in mind, but we might need the Heather loophole to kind of help us all get through these hard economic times. But so there's definitely a reason for it, but it's just, there's just got to be a better way to do it.
We're going to call it the HLH.
The HLH.
The HLH.
Is that what my $20 is going
rule.
Towards? My
yes,
$20?
That's what it's
okay.
actually going
okay,
towards.
Okay, I'll
But you believe
me.
You believe that I needed gas for my car.
You seem very honest. You seem very convincing.
I know. I've been told that before.
Yeah, apparently so. Kyle gave me $20 too, so.
Kyle, do you think that I come across honest and convincing?
Yeah, you seem genuine.
I think I would like to think that I actually am, that I'm not like the next Elizabeth Holmes, just like getting drug money, claiming I need gas in my car. I don't need drug money. I don't do drugs.
So
that'll be the title of the episode. Is Heather Elizabeth Holmes? Question mark.
She's got vision. She's got $40. She's unstoppable. Mm-hmm. Do you have
$40 for gas in my car?
For gasoline. With our conversations on LTDs and on some of the dangers of Elizabeth Holmes, do you have any kind of closing thoughts for us? Heather?
Oh, I thought you were talking to Kyle.
My
whole thing has been my
Kyle's,
thoughts.
Or Kyle's.
Let's defer to Kyle for the closing ones.
I think so, yeah.
My closing thought is, thank God I knew as much as I did about Elizabeth Holmes.
I agree.
Because we didn't plan that at all. I was like,
I didn't see you Google once.
For you, I know.
Not once, Kyle. So you were very prepared.
I think I read like every book on it.
I was about to say, you saw the Amanda, and I can't pronounce her name to save my life. Seyfried.
Amanda Seyfried.
I freaking love her no matter what, even if I can't properly pronounce her name. I'm sorry, Amanda, if you happen to be listening, which seems far-fetched, but just in case,
you never know. Never know. She could be one of our guests in the future.
Yeah, freaking love her. And so I wanted to watch that. It was like all my loves, like the love of the situation. I'm always like, I love documentaries. And then we just add like one of my favorite actresses to a topic that I know is controversial, that I am very passionate about. And lo and behold, you get, like, is it Netflix or Hulu? Like,
it's Hulu,
one?
Yeah.
It's Hulu. You get a Hulu show.
Hulu. But I think they're making a movie with Jennifer Lawrence, if I'm correct.
That would not surprise me.
On the same topic?
Yeah, Elizabeth Holmes.
Is it going to be, like, her prison days? Because I feel like we've beat this horse enough, like. We need something new.
Before Theranos, there was Easy Bake Oven 2.0.
Bologna sandwiches in prison.
Yes, we all have the little things with the light bulbs, the creepy crawler ovens. It's
we'll
kind
let
of
Jennifer
cool.
Lawrence handle the bologna sandwiches, and Amanda S., we'll just say that, handles, you know, the upfront impact. Prior to the bologna sandwiches in prison.
Kyle, do you have any closing words for us?
No, just if the audience wants to read up more on the Theranos thing, there's a book called Bad Blood, which is the journalist that brought the whole case to light, wrote a whole book on it. I think there's a podcast called The Dropout, which it covers it as well, same journalist.
And it inspired the show. The podcast, The Dropout, inspired the show.
And then there's a TV show and a movie coming soon, but the TV show you can find on Hulu.
Anything on lab testing? Words of wisdom?
Thoughts on lab testing?
Any pearls of wisdom?
No pearls for me, just that it'll be interesting to see what the FDA concludes in April and how the labs are going to react. So,
not well.
Hopefully good things.
Hopefully good things.
Good things coming, I mean.
So make sure you validate, verify. Can't just plug it in.
Implement it in. Accuracy, essential agreement, categorical agreement, reproducibility. We'll throw out all the big words as we.
That's a lot
out.
Of stuff. Yeah.
That's a lot of stuff. LDT, FDA, CMS, CLIA, CAP.
CAP? That's.
You guys.
I think that's
Joint Commission.
Yeah. FDA.
JCO.
Yep.
OSHA.
I wanted to put together a transcript with all these abbreviations at the beginning now.
Hey, and that surprisingly, any moment can be your breakthrough moment.
Mm-hmm. I love that. Mm-hmm. Always do what you're inspired to do, unless it's convince people to give you money for something that's manipulative or bad.
Meth. Or meth.
Or for meth. Also, don't convince people to give you money for meth. But if you have an idea, share it. Share it with at least one person. And maybe you too will change the world.
And close.